This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Last week, we visited with the young cellist Laura Medcalf in duo with her guitarist husband Rupert Boyd. This week, we'll chat with another young cellist who is, in every sense, expanding the sound world and range of her instrument, Mariel Roberts. She has been called trailblazing, and even at this early stage of her career, this American artist has completely dedicated herself to new music for the cello through commissioning and collaboration and her own self-exploration of new sounds, techniques, and uncharted areas for this great stringed instrument. She hails from Colorado, but once arriving on the scene in New York City, absorbed and became part of the vibrant new music scene. She has recently released her second recording of brand new works for cello, most of them for her alone, on the New Focus label. Her first recording of solo cello works was on the Innova label, and from that, you're listening to the first minutes of a work by Sean Fryer called Teaser. But what my guest presents in concert or on recordings is no such teaser of grandstanding or pyrotechnic displays with no music substance. She has performed across the globe, and she presents this new music with a maturity, flow, and confidence that is impressive and rare. I met up with her in New York City a few weeks back.
Very happy to be here with cellist, but also slash in some ways composer. We'll get to that. Mariel Roberts. Because I want to talk a lot about the music, because I think that's important in your case, and how you make it come to be and how you perform it. But I need to have our audience back up a little bit on you, which is not easily found. But I'm just wondering how a young musician like yourself, who comes from just outside of Denver, right? Mm-hmm. Colorado, so you lug in a cello case around when you're a kid to orchestra rehearsals and string ensembles and maybe chamber groups and lessons and rehearsals. How do you make that career decision at some point to dedicate so much of your time and talent to the absolute newest music, some of it specifically for you? That's a huge quantum leap for any artist to make. I'm just curious. But take it from your background so you can get us into that.
Yeah, it felt like a natural progression for me. I never felt limited to one type of music. My dad was a jazz musician, so that was a really important type of music in my life. When I was young, I went to an arts high school, so I was around a bunch of different type of performers, artists, visual artists, actors, and people that were just making different types of art. To me, that was normal within your field to be trying something new and to be trying something different. I just was really drawn to that from the beginning, especially in the world of art, like visual art and things like that. So I went through the whole conservatory process, and I love my instrument. I love playing the cello. I love playing classical cello. But to me, the idea of never progressing personally or artistically or staying within a very narrow realm that is the classical repertoire sounded like a death in a way. It sounded like something that was not what my life was really about. So I was always interested in just trying things, and I loved improvising. I loved just playing my instrument in a way that was not attached to anything else.
But as far as the new music goes, especially the stuff you perform, as our listeners will hear, which is just extremely taxing and difficult. Were there mentors? I know one of your teachers, past Cadenza guest, is Fred Sherry. I assume he was a huge, you know, this is okay, kid, go ahead type of thing with Fred. I mean, were there people you looked to say, ah, okay, if my interest goes here, I can still do everything? Because probably your conservatory side was saying, whoa, you know, sit in an orchestra, make get a career, get a string quartet going.
I mean, Fred is amazing, and it's amazing to be around him. I think just moving to New York, honestly, and seeing what people were doing here, my colleagues, as well as my teachers, made me feel like anything was possible in a way, and that pursuing the things that I was interested in was a valuable and okay thing to do. I think moving to New York and just being in New York around so many creative people, so many weird people, so many bizarre people, in a way is really freeing and really made me feel like it's okay to be me and be interested in the things that I'm interested in.
Okay.
In a way that I think that really helped me pursue the things that I loved.
So you actually found you could fit in better here. It didn't scare you. It wasn't like, wow, this is really bizarre.
Yeah.
Okay. I still think it's a huge leap, even in 2017, 21st century, for somebody to say, I'm going to dedicate so much of my time. So if we start rounding to music, you got to go, since not everything in your list is by someone who's still living and breathing, the vast majority of the pieces are. So let's talk about composers.
Yeah.
How do, at this point, are you still seeking them out? Are they finding you? How do you convince them or get them to think of writing a piece for cello, even if it has some other element, whether it's another human being playing another instrument or process sound or something? I mean, that's a whole thing of like, how do you get your roster of composers you've worked with?
I think it's both. Both. I approach composers that I really admire, and I get approached by composers who either like my playing or like the cello or have an idea of something that they think that I could do. And I think the important thing is the community of people within contemporary music is really connected. There's a lot of communication between people doing even different genres within contemporary music. Like, you know each other. You meet at concerts or you meet at festivals, or you just are in contact with people and you can see a person's body of work build up over a long period of time. So the composers that I work with are generally people that either I met in some context getting hired to play a piece of theirs, or I saw something of theirs that I really admired and I thought that they had a beautiful vision of music and a way to make a piece. So I just would approach them, or they would approach me, and I would say, do you think that we could try to work together? Maybe we could try and make a piece together. And usually people are excited to do that.
Is there any convincing, I mean, a composer might think, well, a piece for cello, solo cello, or if I add something to it, you're going to perform it, so it'll have performances, but it's not a big ensemble piece, it's not going to be glitzy. Yeah. I mean, do you have to convince them to say, hey, it's okay, write for solo cello?
I don't feel like I've had to convince someone in that I was twisting their arm. I think, if somebody wants to, is inclined to work on a cello piece, then they're excited to work on it no matter what. It's not really about the number of performances that it's going to get. Obviously, I'm going to try and perform that piece as many times as I can if somebody's writing for me. Also, I don't think it's necessarily about the cello. Like, I don't think people see me as a cello. I think they see me as a person, as a musician, the way that I am to work with, the way that I like to collaborate. And in a way, I'm more than the sum of my instrumental parts, you know? So I think that collaboration is something different than just writing a cello piece, per se.
Well, I think if they listen listen to what you've done, they realize you take the cello and places much beyond just the cello as we know it. So many of the pieces you do, I mean, it's an old term, avant-garde term, but the extended techniques, taking the cello out of its comfort zone of just bowing and pizzicato and that type of thing. The way you execute them, I mean, I'm not the first one to say it, it's just amazing what you do. I mean, some of the techniques you hear just like forget the how did she do that type of thing. They're just like jaw-dropping. So a couple points there. Now, you said that you spend hours, obviously alone, figuring out how to produce different sounds on your instrument.
Yeah.
And that, I assume, goes even outside of something, a piece given to you. You're just trying to figure out what you can do on this instrument, right?
Yeah.
Where does that stem from? I mean, do you then catalog them? Do you pass them on to composers? I mean, how does that...
No, I don't do it really in a methodical way. I just love sound. I love making sound. I love playing my instrument. So I just spend time doing that. And I think it comes out in either improvisation, or I love playing pieces that have a lot of freedom built into them,
right,
where I can express myself in a sonic way that is totally unique to me. And I think those things just come out, and sometimes people hear that and they want to write for that specific thing that I did. Or sometimes if I'm workshopping something closely with a composer, we talk about something, an idea, maybe what I think the composer wants to happen, or the feeling, the ambiance the composer wants to get, and I can offer these things that I know that my instrument is capable of as a solution to musical progress.
Because that's where I was going with. I mean, these are all wonderfully talented, mostly young composers. You've worked with them a lot on the two recordings. I'm sure they're very creative in what they're coming up with. But if you've got the sort of lexicon of things you've been trying out, and you've got to share that so that you say, hey, listen to this sound, and then they put it in their head and they figure out. So, I mean, do these pieces, by the time they end up and they're quote-unquote finished, are they, some of them, collaborations, would you see, between you and the composer? I mean, there's the doses of both of you in there.
Yeah, definitely. And every piece is a scale from one end to the other, a more collaborative and less collaborative. But I think definitely every piece does have collaborative elements to it. And that's something that's really important to me, especially the composers that I choose. If they don't want to work that way, that's not very interesting for me. I don't want somebody to just hand me a piece of paper and say, do this this way. That's not making living art to me. Art is between people,
right,
and music is between people. So that interaction and that collaboration is really important to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm a composer by trade, but I hear you playing these pieces, and I'm going, there is so much of you in this as well as the composer. It has to be, because if they would write a cello piece for another cellist, it wouldn't sound that way. It just simply wouldn't. Maybe, but I doubt it. Yeah, so...
Once again, dipping into that first CD release of my guest Mario Roberts, called Non-Extraneous Sounds on the Innova label, all works composed for her, here are the final minutes of Flutter by Alex Minchik.
Thank you.
some of these things that you pull off, like I said, to the, even an untrained ear, they sound fiendishly difficult to make happen, especially with the precision that has to be where they have to fall. Yet, it's been noted, in reviews, how you sort of do this without angst, as we perform without nervousness. You make it seem like it's flowing, it's natural, it's just like going up and down a C major scale or something like that. Talk about getting to that point of execution in some of these pieces, because that is obviously your goal, because that's one of the things that's mentioned most about when people see you, especially live, and they see you conquering, excuse me, these pieces with these wild techniques, some of them maybe never even done on a cello before. And it's like, this doesn't bother her at all. There's no showy element, like, look what I just pulled off on the cello. You float into the piece. If you get the gist of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, I think that is one skill that I have, is working very, very intensely on something with like a lot of focus towards it. So that is my approach to learning a piece, is I feel like I know the piece when I can no longer make a mistake on that piece. So if something's really difficult, I break it down extensively to be able to play it. Yeah, and I wouldn't perform it if I didn't know that I could totally do it. And in terms of performance, without like trying to show off how difficult the thing I do is, I feel like a technique is not an end in itself. I don't feel like writing techniques is writing music. I think that a lot of those things exist in the music that I play, but it's not about that. It's about making music and projecting the musical ideas beyond the technique that's happening, or beyond the piece being difficult. It's not about whether the piece is difficult or not. It's about the value in the music that's being produced. That, to me, is the most important thing. It's not about me in a lot of ways. I am the person performing it, but I'm merely serving the purpose of presenting this music.
Well, that's really important, though, because, I mean, there was a time, and those pieces are not going to last to the history or have posterity, where pieces were for a show or a certain technique, something, a sound, a specific sound. And once you got past that, there was really nothing in the music. You got up to that point, it's the circus act, right? And they stand on the ball and everybody claps. There's nothing after that.
Yeah.
So that's, I guess, what I'm driving at, is you take these things, which when we first listen to pieces on your recordings, it's like, how crazy sound. But you try to then, you back off of it and put it in context of the piece.
Yeah.
Even if there's a lot of room for you to do what you want in the piece.
Yeah, I think so. Even then, I feel like it's not about, I don't want people to look at me and say, oh, wow, look how well she plays the cello. I want them to think, wow, what a beautiful, thought-provoking piece of music that just happened.
Right.
It's about the experience. It's not about people appreciating the work that I put into learning a piece or playing this technique or something. Right.
Turning to my guest's latest recording on the new Focus label called Cartography, here are the final minutes from Eric Wubel's Gretchen am Spinnrad, taking the famous Schubert song, setting a text by Goethe, as the launching point for this work, where the spinning wheel takes on a roller coaster life of its own, finally shattering. It is performed by the composer on piano, and my guest today, Marielle Roberts on cello.
when you listen to some of these things, just along the lines of what we were talking about, unless you are just an incredible wizard, wizardress, whatever, I don't know how to genderize it. There's multi-tracking going on. You're playing against yourself on some of these pieces, correct?
Occasionally, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just talk about that, how you, in order to accomplish some of what the composer wants, you have to be Mario Roberts times whatever with the magic of the recording studio, correct? That's how some of this is brought off.
Yeah. I'm trying to think about which.
Well, Andy's piece is a good one, but I mean, there's other ones too, especially on the new one, that where it's just the first track on this with this spin, and it's based on the Gretschnaum Spinrad.
Yeah.
But Gretschnaum Spinrad.
Yeah, that's just a piano and cello duo.
That's piano duo.
Yeah. So that's just an acoustic piece which has been written in a way that is kind of sonically shocking.
Yeah.
It sounds not like just a cello and a piano playing with each other, which is incredible. The piano is prepared in some way, so that alters the sound a little bit, but otherwise, Eric Wobbles is an amazing composer. He really understands musical texture and how to get completely different types of sounds, things that you've never heard before. And that's an incredible experience.
Well,
it's
amazing
to play with him as well.
That, too, again, it plays into this. When you're hearing something brand new, you know, someone who puts these on and hasn't heard these pieces, and you're listening to it, and besides the techniques and the piece itself, there is that other level of saying, how did she pull that off?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's that little detective work, too. Your ears are trying to figure it out. It's just, I think it's human nature.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about, like, the multi-tracking things. How do some of these pieces, which are intricate to put onto record, how do they work in live?
I guess the only piece that has a backing track of all of these pieces is Andy Kehoe's.
Okay.
And that piece is pretty rhythmic, but it's hard. It's getting it together live, you kind of have to have a physical memorization of what it feels like to play in real time. There's no click track or anything, so I'm just playing with this backing track, which sometimes is rhythmic, sometimes it's not as rhythmic.
Right.
Yeah, it's a separate skill of learning the physical memorization of what is this supposed to feel like when I come in, what is it supposed to feel like with the track behind. So it's not so different from chamber music, except that you can't give any physical visual cues. So you have to learn to trust your own internal rhythm in a way that you know exactly what this number of beats feels like in your own body, and just remember what that is.
I made the point before that I don't know if these pieces, if that you went to any of these composers and asked them for a piece for cello, solo cello, cello, piano, cello, electronic, it would turn out that way because they know you. What about these pieces having life beyond you, in other cellists' hands?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a history of that? Is there starting to be? These are composed for your technique. It's an amazing technique and skill. So, I mean, talk about life beyond Mario Roberts for these pieces.
Yeah, it's been pretty interesting. There's, I think, just two of the pieces from my first album have been played by other people. The one by Sean Fryer called Teaser has been played by a couple people in Europe.
Yeah, I could see
and
that.
Then Andy Akiho's piece has been played by maybe one other person, maybe two other people. I haven't heard those performances, but it's strange. It's definitely a different piece in other people's hands, especially Andy's has that built-in track, so that will always be the same because it would take a really long time to re-record that, and it's pretty fixed. But with Sean's piece, for example, it's completely different, especially someone with a different perspective, like that has come out of Europe and that type of training has just a different approach to musicality in general or about what a soloist is or about what a solo piece should be. So that's always really wonderful in a way to hear somebody else play it because it kind of reaffirms that each person is incredibly unique and notes on a page do not make the music, a person makes music.
Turning back to her first CD, here are the last, say, two-thirds of a work by composer-percussionist Andy Akiho called Three Shades, Four, F-O-R-E, Four Shadows, composed for and performed here by my guest today, Mario Roberts. Thank you.
you're doing a lot of commissioning here, or people writing for you, however it works out. So you're kind of stirring the drink a little bit on new music with cello.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have cellists that communicate with you, you know, what's they want to know what's being written for you? I mean, they're sort of curious as to your kind of sort of maybe trendsetting a bit is what these young composers will come out of their mind if they come across a talent like yours. I'm just curious. It's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, I get messages from students a lot who are maybe playing a piece that I premiered, either a solo piece or a chamber piece, asking for advice or what is the best way to do this. And I love that. That feels amazing.
You've turned into the mentor.
Yeah, I feel so excited that other young musicians are interested in the music that I feel is really good music.
I don't really know how to phrase this, so I'm just going to say it straight up. Because when you listen to these recordings, they're fabulously fascinating. The cello has another side to it, which of course is the lyrical human voice side.
Yeah.
And maybe except for the last track on the new disc where that exists, there's not a lot of that here.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what about that side of the cello playing? I mean, do you purposely, I don't think purposely, you know, look for pieces that don't nurture that? Or is it just this is what the composer's, I mean, talk about that side.
I think I don't actively pursue that side of the cello that much because it is, I think, by and far the most common use of the cello. And there's lots of people that play beautiful lyrical cello, and they've been doing it for hundreds of years. And I think there's very interesting lyrical pieces as well. I don't have a huge number of them in my repertoire, but there are a few that I do have. I think that is one aspect of what my instrument can do and what I can do as a musician. But I feel like it is such a dominating force in the world of my instrument in particular. Is very susceptible to, I mean, it's beautiful. It's easy to just write a beautiful flowing cello melody. And I'm not really interested in what's easy. I'm interested in what's interesting. So it's sometimes interesting. And it's oftentimes not interesting.
So the new recording, the cartography recording, I mean, we talked a little bit about the first track, the Gretchen am Spinrad.
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to talk about any of that? They're so different, all four of them. I mean, do you want to just sort of briefly touch on, I mean, you go from that first track, which is just a whirlwind, like the roller coaster won't stop, and then finally it slows down, it breaks. And I mean, I know it's the thing realistic.
Yeah.
But then the next one is just so stark. And
yeah.
I mean, talk about the pieces on just a little bit.
Yeah, so the second piece is Aman by Jane Ergen. Well, it's a collaborative piece between he and I. So the piece, in a way, is just this electronic patch that he wrote, a Max patch, which is manipulating my sound in real time. So it's something that we perform together. In that way, it's also totally different every time. None of the elements are set. And even from the last time we performed it, from this recording, has changed quite a bit. So that's a really amazing piece to perform because it can be totally different every time, as I said. But the core of it is this kind of very bare, stark, as you said, repressed feeling. Yeah, there's really amazing possibilities with that piece to go.
And the genesis of that is actually some of the horrors of recent warfare, which you saw. The piece doesn't try to portray musically the horrors of war. It's a reaction to it and the internal take.
Like, this is the things that he was feeling and that I was feeling at that time, and this came out. This is the music that was within us at that time.
Right. And then George Lewis's piece, solo cello, tied up with mythology and all that. But he's had a career that's gone in and out of various different styles and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And you can kind of hear it in various places here. He can't kind of resist himself from either hitting a groove or something like that. So I mean, he's an interesting character, though, to have on here. I didn't expect a solo cello piece from him, put it that way.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I was amazed that he had time to write a solo cello piece for me. Yeah, he's somebody that I've admired so much for a really long time. I think he's an unbelievable musician and an unbelievable mind, musical mind. He just thinks about so much, and he's never, this is really hard, I think, for a lot of composers. He's never closed to any ideas. He's really always pushing himself to try something different in a way that I think is totally egoless and incredible. Like, a George Lewis piece can kind of sound like anything. A lot of times it sounds very intense and a little hectic because he has a history of playing a lot of improvised music and of just being in the more free jazz world as well. But it literally could have been anything, this piece. And this is what happened, and I think it's a great piece. But I really love that about him, and I admire that a lot, that he has no limits on what he's going to do musically.
And the final piece, the cartography of time.
Mm-hmm.
There's times in this piece where you're just kind of floating on top of what's happening,
mm-hmm.
sort of disembodied type of thing happening, as because time from the past, present, or future. Just a few words about that.
Yeah, I think that piece is also very reflective of the people involved in it. Well, David is from Iceland,
yeah.
And to me, the piece is very reflective of that landscape. It's very cold and glacial in pace, but I think the way that it unfolds is incredibly beautiful. Like, he has a ear for pace that I think is incredible, that not many people have.
Right.
And the rate of development with just enough change where it feels like a lot of things are happening when actually very little things are happening.
And some of the, we talked about taking sounds out of the cello, which are not normal, and then you play with drumsticks at times, things like this. I think it's at the end of Eric's piece that there's this technique which you sound like a didgeridoo. Or the combination of what's happening sounds like a didgeridoo. And
yeah.
You're going, how did, you know, that's the idea, how did they come up with that?
Back to my guest Mariel Robert's latest CD and some minutes from the title track, a work by Icelandic-born New York-based composer David Brynjar Franzen called The Cartography of Time.
How does your career move from here? I mean, recordings are still great and you're making them. It gets them out there so more people can hear them. So that's,
yeah.
I assume you'll keep doing recordings.
Yeah.
But what do? You just keep commissioning, looking for new works? Is that how you want this all to play out over the next decade or so?
Yeah, I definitely want to commission more pieces. I also want to champion the pieces that I have commissioned.
Sure.
And just do more live performances in general. I think that's something that's really important for people, especially that don't have a ton of exposure to contemporary music, is if you see a live performance of a piece of challenging music, it's completely different than hearing a recording, right, for example. And I think that's something that I've realized more as years go by, is that people need to experience musical events live to really understand more difficult music or to really appreciate it.
And multimedia, you can use multimedia, things like that.
Yeah, that too. But I think just the live experience of a person performing a piece of music directly in front of you is
right,
really powerful. And we're not that used to it anymore because we have so many media outlets, our phones, our computers that we're constantly attached to, that we expect that to be our media source, and that live performances are, in a way, much more rare than they used to be.
Are there composers out there who you've heard the music and you like the music and you haven't been able to hook them in yet?
Oh yeah, lists of composers that I want to work with.
Okay.
Yeah, I definitely want to keep working on new pieces and larger pieces and different types of projects.
Emails will be going out. emails and sound files. Before we wrap, I've had great cellists on this program over the 12 years. It's going on the 17th year. And every cellist, I ask the same question. Just because you focus on so much new music, cellists have this body of music that was given down to them by mm-hmm. Bach, which is yours. Mm-hmm. And people can make arrangements and do anything they want, but it's cellos. It's, you know. How do they play? I mean, I've had cellists who, they wake up and that's the first thing they do.
Mm-hmm.
Quite part of a box suite. I'd be curious on how they fit into your career. What role do they play?
I feel the same way, actually. Like, that is my ideal day, is I wake up and I play a box suite.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really an important part of my connection to my instrument, I think. They're just so beautifully perfect for our instrument, and the music's so perfectly expressed.
Can you go from that into one of these new pieces? I know it can inform it and give mm-hmm. it perspective. What about just the mind shift of going like something from playing a Bach to going and playing one of these pieces? I'm just curious.
Oh, I think they're crucial for informing each other, actually. I feel like my contemporary playing gets much worse when I'm not practicing Bach, and I also feel like my Bach playing gets much worse when I'm not playing contemporary music.
Huh.
I think they inform each other in a really important way that I wish that people who taught in universities and things like that understood, because it changes your perspective on the nature of creating sound, on the nature of creating a phrase. The hierarchy of musical ideas within a piece, I think, are so connected between these two types of music. So, yeah, it's really important for me to always include that in my regular practice.
Well, it's good to hear. Well, I wish you the best of success going forward. I mean, these are fascinating CDs. I assume the next one will be too. And it's not just the choice of composers, but it's how you approach music. And that's been noted. You approach the music that this is not a one-off. It's not a circus show. This is your life. This is what you live to play a cello for. Mm-hmm. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. First one's hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been doing with someone from the past that you never had a chance to. What's the first name? Don't think about too much.
Chat with someone from the past?
Yeah.
A musical person?
Doesn't have to be. I've had God to Groucho Marx, but Box the runaway number one answer. But when I said that, just the first person that popped into your head, if you could just sit down with somebody, who would you love to talk to?
I'm going to go with King Hannibal.
Okay. Explain why.
Oh, I love history.
Okay.
I feel like he's a very interesting person in history in terms of his thoughts and his tactics and the way that his military campaigns went.
Okay. All right. Needless to say, you're the first person to choose that. If it had to be somebody from music, I'm just curious.
From music?
I'm just curious. Because you deal so much in the now.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if there's anybody from the past that you think could help you inform what you do.
Maybe Gesualdo. I'd love to talk to Gesualdo.
Dangerous person. You know?
Yeah. Between a plexiglass wall, maybe.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Yeah. Hannibal Lecter. Well, just the first part, when he went into depression, he was fine. That's interesting, because he was somebody who just thought way outside of what was
normality.
Yeah,
I would love to figure out what informed his musical choices.
That'd be a project for composers, mix Gesualdo in for cello. Yeah. Final thing is a non-musical question, meaning everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy all the time. When you do have to do something non-musical, take yourself away from music, pleasure, relaxation, John, what do you do?
Anything outside.
Okay.
I love being outside, hiking, swimming. biking.
Just nature in general?
Yeah.
Just getting outside?
Yeah.
Do you have time to do that?
Yeah, I make time to do it. There isn't time, but the time that you have is the time that you make.
Yeah, because the overall impression is that your practice time probably dwarfs a lot of other cellists' practice time. It may not be true, but I mean, there's so much that you have to ingest with these pieces. Mariah Roberts, thanks for taking some time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Cellist Marielle Roberts. You can find out more about her at her website, Marielle, M-A-R-I-E-L, Roberts.com, including her two recordings from which we sampled on this program, on the Innova label, the CD called Non-Extraneous Sounds, and on the new Focus label, her latest called Cartography. I leave you with more music from that disc from the American composer, electronic performer, installation artist, trombone player, and scholar in the fields of improvisation and experimental music, George Lewis. Though my guest would have liked to have met Hannibal from ancient days, this work is based on ancient Greek culture, and the work, sometimes beneficial, sometimes not, to mortals of the fates. These are the final minutes of the work called Spinner, composed for and performed by my guest today, Mariel Roberts. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network at WWFM.org. ¶¶